The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today we have a guest, Dr. Chris Martinson. He's a pathologist, fascinating guy. He probably brought to light more understanding of the exponential function than anything that I've ever read. I've read a lot of math, but this guy actually made it real.
Well, Kevin, I think I spend more time reading about finance and economics than I do petri dishes and bacterial growth. So part of the reason why it was particularly different and fresh was because it was from a different field. And I think this is one of the things to point out. Chris is one of those guys who's been able to transition from one particular field of thought, pathology, into something very different, specifically economics. And the tie-ins when you're looking at energy, the environment, and in particular inputs into our economic system, he does that well. I think a part of the reason he does it is because he does it on an interdisciplinary basis. And Kevin, he wrote a book called The Crash Course, The Unsustainable Future of Our Economy, Energy, and the Environment. And it is a great summary piece. It's a summary piece because there's a lot of things that we've discussed in the commentary. There's a lot of things that we've read about elsewhere. And I think as an introduction to a lot of these issues, he does a great job in bringing it together in one source.
One of the things I like, he practices what he preaches. Okay, we've been talking about how this debt, this monetary system, this, you know, environment, energy, whatever, it's unsustainable at the rate that we're using it at this point. We already know that. I mean, they raise the debt ceiling and everybody's just looking at this going, come on, really, guys, this isn't really even affecting the real problem. And you've been bringing this out. But when Martinson figured this out, he downsized. He changed his life. He did the things step by step that we talk about with our clients, you know, simplifying and getting out of debt and getting tangible assets and getting land and having some sort of sustainability. One of the things that I really liked about his book, Dave, was he said, look, anything you do is probably going to be insufficient, but do it anyway. He says you need to be doing something anyway. And you and I have talked about this before. One of the things that makes people freeze in their tracks when they see these huge looming issues is they think, oh my gosh, well, this is completely unsurvivable anyway, so I'm going to do nothing.
Well, moving beyond paralysis, Kevin, I'm reminded of Aristotle's comment that human flourishing is found in action. And I respect that about him. I respect that he saw the issues and adjusted his lifestyle and is now in a different environment and taking a different approach to life in total for the benefit of himself and his family.
I'm really looking forward to your talk with him. You know, he not only did what he said he was going to do, but then he published it in a way that it's very understandable to any reader.
There's an idea that Chris Martinson brings up in his book, The Crash Course, and I think it's worth mentioning. What is a world worth inheriting? I think it's an appropriate idea to keep in mind, and particularly important in an age like ours, one that tends towards narcissism. It serves as a reminder of both ethical and moral responsibilities to coming generations. And it helps us make choices in light of oughts, things that we should keep in mind as an imperative. We could take a comprehensive look at your efforts, Chris, of the last few years, and you're well-versed with many different issues. We'll look at a wide range of topics. I do want to take the opportunity, as we have you online with us today, to reflect with you on a number of concepts I found particularly interesting, and just allow the listener to gain an appreciation for Chris Martinson, PhD, you, the man, the person. And I'll assume right away that our listeners will be ordering your book for a detailed discussion of the issues which you've prioritized in that book, specifically the economy and energy and the environment. And you do a very good job there. So without further ado, I want to begin with one of the ideas early in your book, identifying false narratives. This seems to be a major issue because for many people, they get very excited about a particular thematic, a particular cause, and it seems they may, in fact, be misguided. Some of that's because of the news media. Some of that's because of educational biases. Some of that's just flat being misinformed. Let's talk about that. Like looking at a map before beginning a journey, let's talk about false narratives.
Well, it's just so important important. And by the way, thank you for that lovely introduction. Narratives run our lives, whether it's our personal lives or we're talking about a corporation or a whole country. So, you know, stop me if you've heard this story before, right? Houses always go up in price. You know, we had that narrative. It ran all the way up until about 2006, 2007, depending on where you lived. Whole pricing models were built off of it. The risk models that I was looking at from Moody's didn't even include the possibility of negative returns on houses when they were looking at the risk functions. And so there was that story, and it was just a story, right? You could look at history and discover that it wasn't a true story, but it was held, widely held, deeply embedded, and as a consequence of believing and holding that story that houses always go up in price, a lot of very bad mistakes were made. Malinvestments were made, houses were built that shouldn't have been, money was poured into places that shouldn't have, risky loans were packaged and sold off by people who shouldn't have bought them, etc. And so that's the power of when I say we have to have the right narratives in play. If you have the wrong one in play, like we had with housing, that's a very damaging experience. And so the question I try to raise is, what other stories do we have running today that maybe deserve to be questioned, that if they turn out to be false, we would have been really in worse, much worse shape for having believed them? And, you know, one of the biggest ones out there that I think is just starting to emerge that for most people and investors is this idea that we need to be able to grow our debts, our economy, our money supply exponentially forever. You know, that's a story. We always want more growth. We need economic growth. We've told ourselves that. We're holding that story. That's the highest level story we have economically. Got to have growth. Need to cut it back soon. The most recent Treasury statement by Geithner, I think, had 41 references to growth in it. And there it is. And nobody really questions it. And that's one of the things that I've been doing lately is asking the unthinkable, which is, what happens if we can't count on growth in the future like we've had in the past? Well, all sorts of pricing models for stocks, indexes in particular, in aggregate, for bonds, the whole universe of bonds, all of the pricing models go right out the window. And so do the risk models, right out the window. And perhaps it's an unthinkable concept, and maybe I've got it wrong, but I think people at least deserve to consider it and understand the theory that goes behind why it might be that we are at a place where growth, as we've known it and enjoyed it over the past decades, is not going to be an available option to us here for the next few decades.
That's certainly an easy concept to sell. Exponential growth ad infinitum in the future. Consumerism is an interesting overlay to that issue, wherein people either falsely assume a relationship between stuff and happiness, or even we witness individuals escaping the drudgery of life by owning more material goods. Again, sort of the false narrative of finding one's identity in one's possessions or material goods. False indeed, but it's an interesting thing. We can afford more, we can buy more, we can add more stuff when we assume that we are on that exponential growth curve from here on into the future.
Absolutely. If just make it very personal, if I am under the assumption that my salary is going to go up 10% per year from here into the future forever, I should have no problem taking on 5% more debt year over year. The story works very well. As soon as we have a question, though, about our income flattening out, at that point, obviously taking on more and more debt, particularly in pursuit of goods that are simply going to be consumed, you know, debt taken on for the purpose of consumption rather than for investment or capital improvements or things like that. I'm not a guy who just says all debt's bad, but there are types of debt, particularly non-self-liquidating debts, the debts we take on to simply consume. Those are the ones that you really have to keep a careful eye on, because there's an assumption baked into those that they're going to get paid back, and that when they're always growing, that the future is going to be much larger than the present. And those are the pieces that I'm convinced aren't really true anymore. And you've raised a really good point a couple of times here. You know, for me, happiness is wanting what I have, not having what I want. It's being satisfied with what we have. And certainly in my own life, I've managed to really deconstruct my life, taking my standard of living way down, maybe cut my standard of living in half. Smaller house, older cars, got rid of the boat, all kinds of things, did things that reduce that. And I think my quality of life has doubled. So I've discovered in my own life there's no direct connection for me between stuff and happiness. In fact, I think the correlation is inverse past a certain point. And this is something that, and we get back to that idea of narratives, if you hold narrative in your head that losing your stuff is going to be a bad thing, it'll be a horrible experience, you will not like it. If you hold a story that says, wow, if I can pare down the amount of stuff I have and I will be happier as a result, you'll love the experience. Same thing is happening in both cases, but in one case it's a really miserable experience, and in the other case it's a really lovely experience. And this is where I think we are. I think we're at the point where sort of the physical dimensions of where we are in terms of amount of debt in the oil story and peak oil and the amount of resources that are out there and the competition for food, minerals, all that, we're at this part of the story where those who are armed with the idea of how to be happier on less, I think, are in a better position to win, to feel better, and navigate this next decade.
Chris, it was about 10 years ago. You mentioned taking stock of your current income and saying, you know, what happens if I increase at 10% per year? I did that very thing about a decade ago. But to that equation, I was attaching how much more of a percentage of my income am I going to save? Moving not from a standard 10% or 20%, but continually ratcheting it higher and higher as I went. And it brings me to the second concept. And this is actually a concept that was sort of my initial introduction to you. And I thought, this is a really bright guy. Who's this guy with a PhD in pathology? So maybe he's got an MBA. Lots of people have MBAs. I appreciate sort of this multidisciplinary approach in which you're sitting there talking about petri dishes and bacterial growth and tying in what we know in economics is the rule of 72, or just in mathematics, what is sort of an exponential function. And that's essentially what I did 10 years ago, is say, no, I really would like to see a higher savings rate and a greater investment thematic in our family. And that rule of 72 is what I was familiar with. You just put it in a very elegant, amazing to call what you'd find in a petri dish elegant. But that was my impression. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the exponential function, the difference between linear versus exponential growth.
I'd be happy to, because I think this is really one of the most important concepts. You know, we don't live in a linear world. Linear meaning we might grow something from 1 to 2, and then from 2 to 3, and from 3 to 4, and 4 to 5. So we're just adding 1 every time. The amount doesn't change. What we have in our whole world around us, whether we're looking at the number of people that are coming on board every year and occupying this planet, or whether we're talking about the number of paperclips sold, road miles paved, or the economy, what we're talking about is something that grows by some percent every year, maybe 1%, 2%, 3%. They're very tame-sounding numbers. I mean, you and I wouldn't race down to the store for 2% off on jeans, right? So 2% might escape our notice as something that's important. But human population is growing at about 1.5% right now, and that means 78 million new people on the planet this year compared to last year. You know, that's five or six New York cities. And exponential growth, then, is anything that's growing by some percentage per year, no matter how tame, even if it is just that 1.5%. And what it means is we take last year's stock and we grow it by some percentage. You know, everything that was there last year plus 1%, 2%, 3%. And when we do that, you end up and put that on a chart. You have this thing that looks like a hockey stick on the chart, right? It starts out low and flat, and then, you know, it turns up very rapidly. And this isn't some arcane mathematical concept that needs to be discussed in the ivory towers. This is the world we live in. We're surrounded by exponential charts, whether it's soil erosion or the amount of fish taken out of the ocean, or it's growth in debt, or it's the money supply. They're everywhere. So understanding that we live in an exponential world is part one, and then part two is trying to get our heads around, well, what does that mean, right? Because we're not wired to understand exponential growth intuitively. We're humans. We think linearly. So here's an example. If I gave you two erasers and asked you to put one in each hand and hold your arms out as wide as you could, and I want you to bring those two erasers as close together as you could, as smoothly as you could, you'd do a great job. Now, let's replace those erasers with two very strong magnets, right? You'll be really good right until they get close, and all of a sudden, boom, they'll come together really fast because the pull between those magnets is not linear, it's exponential. And I'll give you 100 times to do that, and if you're like everybody else, you will still not quite be able to get it right because our brains aren't really wired for it intuitively. So that means we have to spend a little bit of time wrestling with this as a concept intellectually to really get it in our bodies. And here's where I found that most everybody who goes through that part of the book or the online crash course, which is in video form, it's a really helpful chapter because it helps understand the main concept behind exponential functions, which is that they really speed up at the end. And it gives us some important context for the world we live in, where if it seems like things are going faster, technology's changing so fast I can't keep up with it. Wait a minute, there's more rules than I can possibly follow and coming on every year. And look at the change and the speed of the changes that are going on around the world and around us. All of that is being driven by this exponential behavior. So it's really a part of understanding the world we live in. And then the third part that I like people to do is understand the implications of that, because nothing can grow exponentially forever in a physical, finite world and planet. And we happen to be alive, I'm convinced, at the most interesting point in human history, when many of these exponential curves are going to flatten out and maybe even reverse. And this is brand new. We don't have experience with this. We don't have historical knowledge. We don't have any financial models. We don't know what happens, frankly, anybody, myself included, what happens when you take an exponentially based money and debt system and then run that headlong into a bunch of exponential curves for resources that cannot keep up with the demands being placed on them. This is brand new territory. It's why I say there's huge changes coming. We need to be ready for those changes. We need physical readiness, financial readiness, emotional readiness. All kinds of things are going to shift. And that's the view I bring forward into the world. For me, change is not scary. It's something to be embraced. There's as much opportunity in this as there is frightening challenges. But the difference between occupying those two places is seeing these changes before they actually get started and being positioned before they get underway, because exponential functions really speed up at the end. That's the thing.
Well, and going back to your initial idea of identifying false narratives, one of the things that you suggest is that you organize your response and categorize this as an opportunity when and if you've started with an awareness of actual problems and deficiencies, number one. Secondly, deepened your understanding of those very issues. And then third, crafted intelligent responses to the issues as you understand them. So there is a proactive stance. This is not sort of a resignation, if you will. Just other examples of exponential growth that come to mind, you know, 0 to 1 trillion in debt until the Reagan administration. And from Reagan until now, it's grown a bit. You know, 14 trillion officially on the books, with the debt ceiling being raised several trillion here recently. And we'll fill that gap in a heartbeat. Inflation in the 70s. We watched this pattern as you went from tame inflation of 2%, 3% to 6, 8 to 12 to 16, and it happened very, very quickly. And it was something that, again, probably 0 to 50, and it took 5 minutes, and then from 50 to 300 miles an hour, you were there in a blink of an eye. Mm-hmm. And so it's something that we've encouraged our listeners to keep in mind, too, because we are approaching that kind of a phase with a number of different markets. The debt markets come to mind because that's in the news. The precious metals markets, they've done very well for 10 years, but it's been very steady. Two steps forward, one step back behavior, modest, measured growth, and at some point we will begin to see a parabolic rise in the price. Now, you point out that there's also concerns in terms of energy consumption and a basic disjuncture between the supplies and overall demand. Which do you tend to focus more on, the supply side, demand side, or maybe you want to explore energy with us a little bit?
Well, it's a great question. I look a little bit more on the supply side, because I'm convinced that whatever supply comes out of the ground, there will be demand for it. The demand is sort of the plug factor here. And that's new. It used to be that demand, it was inverted. Demand was what you would have to track, because, you know, then we would pump out what people could consume. That's shifting now. You know, there was just a fascinating article in the money and investing section of the Wall Street Journal yesterday where they took the top seven oil companies, and they said, wow, all of them had declining production last year. And then they gave this litany of excuses for each one. Well, there was the Libya situation that took down these two companies, and oh, there was unrest in Nigeria, and wait a minute, there was BP hasn't really recovered from the Gulf situation. And so they gave all of these reasons, and it was fascinating, because not once did they mention the real reason, which is that, yes, they had trouble in some of those spots, but these companies occupy every corner of the globe. There have always been issues like that somewhere at some point in time. What hasn't been true in the past is that their other fields in the non-trouble areas were not past peak production, were not in decline already. Norway fell, you know, right out of the top rankings with a plummet. You know, their fields are collapsing at, if I can use that word, at 11, 12% a year. It's just really a stunning decline. Mexico is going to get there shortly, et cetera. We can go through the whole list, but we don't need to, because what's happening here is that all of the existing fields where we get cheap and easy oil from, all of those, with the exception of a couple in the Middle East at this point in time, are past peak. And So I watch that supply side a lot, because the supply side is going to be the place where we're going to first, as a nation and as a globe, come to grips with the idea that there just isn't as much as we would like. And there'll be some price rationing at first. There might even be physical rationing, second of all. But the event I'm looking for here is what happens when the world suddenly utters those two words together, peak and oil, in openly in the international sphere. I think things change very rapidly. I think there's a dividing line in history where we say there's PO, there's before peak oil, there's BPO, and then there's after peak oil. And before peak oil, we thought of the world this way, and after peak oil, we thought of it that way. And, you know, so here I watch supply very carefully because of, we say there's around 88 million barrels per day being produced globally. That's one number, but the number we really care about is that about 35 million barrels come up and go across out into the oceans and are available for export. So it's really the export markets I'm watching very carefully in all of this, rather than the much larger overall number. Because what we care about, obviously, would be peak in our country here, where we import two-thirds of our oil needs. We care about the export market more than we care about how much is available in total in the world. And so there we have two exponential functions working against us. One is declining production in a lot of countries out there, and at the same time, rising demand internally in each of those countries. And that's true of every country, Saudi Arabia, all of them. So when you have some percentage decline every year and some percentage increase in local demand every year, those are like two exponential functions pinching on what's left over for export. And so that's why I'm watching that export market very carefully, and there's all kinds of warning signs out there now that anybody who cares to can find easily. And I honestly think it's the thing we should be focusing on more than the debt drama in D.C., because I think it has more powerful and lasting implications and impacts on our daily lives as we go forward than the debt drama.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
Let's try this on for size. Let's say that the cheap and easy oil, that excess is now behind us. We're on a declining trend. But we would both agree and I think argue that we're also getting past that point of exponential economic expansion, exponential growth in the economy. And even today, you know, we're trying to prop up aggregate demand here in the United States with a GDP number of over $14 trillion. Deficit spending today, which has stepped in by the deficit spending by the government and stepped in and replaced the consumer to the tune of one, looks like this year might actually be closer to $1.7 trillion. So I mean, we're trying to hold up the facade of quote-unquote growth, even when it's already past tense. The question is, if that economic expansion and growth is past tense, isn't energy a lesser issue as demand decreases?
One of the issues here, though, is that oil demand is really, really inelastic. You know, the economy can plunge quite a lot, and, you know, global trade was down, I think in 2009, it was down almost 40%, and oil demand was down, too, but it was down by about 4%. So there's really 95% of everything that goes from point A to point B moves because of crude hydrocarbons, because of petroleum. 95%. So if you want something to go from point A to point B, there are a lot of things that, regardless of whether the economy is doing well or poorly, food, we still need the food to move from point A to point B. And, you know, most people haven't lost their jobs. They still need to get to work and, you know, et cetera and so forth. It turns out that, from my point of view, is that oil is really a non-negotiable lubricant of all economic progress. So even if we held our economy flat, dead flat, 0% growth, we're not going to have any economic growth going forward, our oil demand would still be there and still be there relatively strongly. So what happens if, in that world that you've posited, where economic growth is leveling off, flattening out, but we don't have sufficient supplies? Well, prices are going to go up. And so think of it as a giant sort of a spigot where we pull this oil out of the ground and we can do whatever we want with it. And as the cheap and easy oil goes away, we're left with this harder stuff, right? You know, the Deepwater Horizon, yeah, that was in 13,000 feet of underburden plus 5,000 feet of water. But that's not even close to the deepest ones we're drilling. You know, we're going after this heavy tar stuff that almost has to be taken out of the ground with a spatula. You know, it's just really not the beautiful stuff that we first had access to. And so what's happening here is this spigot, instead of pulling up all this oil and just sending it out into the economy to be used however it wants, it's taking a larger and larger share and turning it back on itself to fund, if you will, the higher energy intensiveness of getting this lower quality energy out of the ground. So As we do that, it means we just have less left over for society to do whatever it wants with, and this is really part and parcel of why I believe we've thrown trillions of dollars into the economy, and it's just not working like it used to. And part of that story is the big debt overhang that's creating a drag. And I think another significant and growing part of that story is the degree to which there's just simply less energy available flowing into and through these economies for that money to go and catch a hold of and light on fire and do fun stuff with. It's really an important concept, and it's the concept of how much net energy we have left over. So we take some energy, we find some energy, whatever's left over in the gap between those two, when we subtract one from the other, that's our net energy. That's declining. That's where we happen to be at. So, you know, if we had really good data, which would be fabulous, but we don't, we would be able to track the net energy we're getting out of all of our efforts in the world, and we don't have that. So we track how many millions of barrels we are actually getting and things like that. But that's hiding a really important part of this story, which is that as we move to these more expensive, lower grades hydrocarbons, we are going to discover that we just can't operate our economy in quite the same way we used to. That's not a big problem because we could reorganize it. The problem is when you have your leaders, your monetary fiscal authorities, attempting to preserve the status quo, wanting us to get back to how things were just functioning, which is totally normal response on their part. They were trained in it. They were raised in it. And they can't see the forest for the trees. I totally understand what they're doing, but they're going to be, and we're going to be, increasingly disappointed with how things are not responding like they used to, how things aren't working like they used to, how things are mysteriously remaining broken and we don't understand why. And it's because you can't just look through that one economic lens anymore. You can't just look at monetary policy and understand what's about to happen next. It's a large, complicated system, and energy is a really important component of that system. In fact, I would argue it is the base of the pyramid of this system, and the economy is actually secondary to the energy foundation. And once we hold that view, a lot more things begin to make sense. What we're seeing in the world today, I think, is more predictable and understandable once we get that view locked in place.
There's three other concepts that I think are incredibly beneficial in terms of just changing the way people see and perceive things around them, and maybe even their own personal circumstances. One, you suggest the difference between growth versus prosperity. I'd like to talk about that. And in a minute, talk about the hierarchy of wealth that you lay out between primary, secondary, and tertiary forms of wealth. And then just as we close, maybe looking at the difference between a problem versus a predicament and, you know, defining something of a course, a way forward, what we talked about earlier, an opportunity. How is radical change something that is to be looked forward to, or at least anticipated and adjusted to? You know, starting with growth versus prosperity. You know, 1965, 14% of the population here in the United States lived below the poverty line. Today, after massive economic growth, there's 14.3% of the population still living in poverty. I mean, that's commentary on many things, but focus on that same theme, growth versus prosperity.
I like to decode those two words and separate them, because we see growth elevated and exalted in the language. You know, you open up the New York Times or the Washington Post, and there's some economic guru or political leader talking about the importance of growth, and they never really explain why we need that growth or why we'd want it. It's just accepted. Of course we want growth. Well, why do you want economic growth? Well, we actually want economic growth because we have more opportunities then, and it ends up with new technology. So actually, when we talk about it, I think what we mean is we actually want more prosperity. I don't really care if the economy grows 1,000,000%. I want to be more prosperous next year than this year. And so because we've had both growth and prosperity for so many decades happening together, I think a lot of people have confused the two and thought that, well, the way you get prosperity is you get growth first, and with growth comes prosperity. But they're actually separate concepts. So we can easily have growth without prosperity. You mentioned one example with look at all this economic growth, had lots of it, and poverty is still, you know, pretty much the exact same percentage it was 50 years ago. There are countries with huge, giant cities that have grown enormously where you would be hard-pressed to describe them as prosperous cities. So growth can happen without prosperity. That much is clear. And we can also have prosperity without any growth. I personally feel more prosperous, even though I've cut my expenses pretty far and trimmed down you know, a lot of the stuff that I have, and I feel more prosperous anyway. So let's decouple these things and understand that what we really want, I hope, as a country, as individuals, is we want to be more prosperous. I want my children and their children to grow up into a world with more opportunities, not less. And I'm convinced that if we just pursue growth without being mindful of what we're really after, which is prosperity, we'll get growth. I mean, that's what we'll get. But it's not going to be what we want. And what we'll end up with is growth for its own sake, and we'll discover that we actually live in a world that's not nearly what we would have intentionally created if we'd had the right narrative in mind, the right understanding around those words. So I tease growth and prosperity apart a lot. I'm convinced that growth becomes destructive when you attempt to grow in an environment where the growth is now stealing from your prosperity, because you're spending your last valuable resources to make things bigger, but not better.
Our economy is obviously predicated on growth, and I think some of this goes back to the elimination of the business cycle as a consequence of adopting, or at least allowing, a Keynesian consensus to be what dominates our not only political theories, but certainly monetary thematics. Fed intervention is there at every step. When there should be a correction in the business cycle, we reliquify and reliquify and reliquify, because we really don't want to see the dark side of a deflation, or the dark side of a devaluation, or a dark side of, it's just not something that we particularly like. And maybe that's been seared into our minds with memories of the Great Depression, but we are fixated on the opposite, which is growth. And I think one of the things that misses, and you do point out in your book, is it's natural for things to ebb and flow. It is natural. And when that doesn't happen, when there's not seasonality, you end up distorting growth to something that ultimately dies because it never got to take a breath. It never got to rest. Hierarchy of wealth, you define money, just transitioning themes. You define money as a claim on wealth, and that's a very unique definition of money. Often people will look at the characteristics of money and what constitutes money. It has to have this quality and that quality and this quality. You're defining money as a claim on wealth, simply an instrument used to exchange for real wealth. So maybe you can talk to us about those tiers of wealth, the primary, secondary, and tertiary.
I'd love to, because I think this is a big theme that's going to be emerging. It actually already is. We can see this theme coming out, and here's how I'll explain it. Once upon a time, people's wealth was easy to measure. It was how much land did you have, right? In the landed gentry and royalty, you know, the more land you had, the wealthier you were. And that was easy to understand, right? If you had rich soil, you could farm it or have somebody farm it for you, and that rich soil then is your primary source of wealth. I mean, it's just sitting there. It's not really doing anything, but you have that rich soil, and so you farm it. And you can take that primary wealth of the soil and turn it into secondary wealth, which would be something that we would transform out of that. So in the case of soil, we grow corn, and take the corn and turn it into flour, all physical, tangible representations of secondary wealth. And the real wealth is in the flour that comes out of that, or the cornmeal, because we can eat that and it has actual utility. But, you know, we learned early on that bartering corn for leather didn't always work out well, and we came up with varying forms of money. And money is an abstraction then. Money is a claim. We agree that this money that I have can be exchanged for something that you might have. And so money itself at one point was also very tangible. It was hard metal, silver and gold, things like that, which themselves embodied an enormous amount of human labor to get up out of the ground and out into circulation. And so it was both had energy and effort and implied rarity all baked into it. So it was good as money. And so here we have this primary wealth, whether that's rich ore bodies or fishing grounds or the soil I mentioned or trees or whatever, and then we convert that into secondary forms of wealth, which is lumber and steel and food on the plate. And then we built up this third order or tertiary wealth around that, which is all the paper money that we've built up and put around. And right now, I would dare say that our society is fascinated with that tertiary wealth. I mean, that's how we know how wealthy someone is. How many of those paper dollars do they have? Or, you know, how many of these credit default swaps is that person managing? You know, that's how we measure everything right now. But in truth, if we didn't have primary wealth, there's no secondary wealth to be had. You know, no soil, sorry, no food. And without food, the tertiary wealth has no meaning. It literally has no meaning. It's an abstraction. So if once we have this view, we can sort of say, look, primary wealth precedes secondary wealth, and both of those have to precede tertiary wealth, that in fact, money itself doesn't make these other two things happen or exist. Money itself only has meaning and value because these other two things are in place. And so I think that, you know, once upon a time that was really well understood. Nobody confused money and wealth at one point in the time, and I think we've confused it a bit, and we think that money is wealth. And in fact, money is only wealth if it can do something for you, if it can lay a claim to, if it can possess or in some way consume one of these primary or secondary sources of wealth. And that's the great pendulum, I think, that's starting to swing back. I mentioned there's early evidence of that. We can see that in farm land prices. We found out that Goldman Sachs has been stuffing warehouses with aluminum, and the great commodities boom is on. If you look at the continuous commodity index from 2002 to today, it is just an absolute rocket ride, compounding at a little over 14% per year. This represents, I think, at least the early stages of this tertiary wealth, looking for something to do, all this paper money, looking for something to do and starting to squeeze back down in through some fairly narrow doorways into secondary and even primary sources of wealth.
It's a great contrast between the independent source and the dependent claim. And you make this point. Our money, debt, stocks, bonds have a high value in a world of constant economic growth and a much lower value in a world without economic growth. And if that, in fact, is the case, we're reaching the point where exponential growth is exhausted and cannot continue. Markets still seem to be pricing in a return to that old normal where tertiary is just fine, thank you very much. You look at the valuations in the stock market today, and they would imply that people still have a tremendous amount of faith in stocks and bonds. It'll be interesting to see as people awaken or realize that it actually is nothing but paper promises to pay, where exactly they go, and what their buying behavior looks like. I'm curious about this contrast between a problem versus a predicament. Problems have solutions, predicaments have outcomes. Maybe you can just tell us about the difference between looking at one versus the other. And do you see us in a predicament, and how do we factor in a strategic plan from this point forward?
It's a critical distinction, I think, because often I hear things phrased in terms of, here are some problems, and we're going to solve them. And I love solving problems. I think knowing that you're facing a problem, I'm the first guy out there to start banging around on solutions. So that's all well and good. The difficulty comes in is that sometimes you're actually facing a predicament. And predicaments don't have solutions. They just have outcomes, right? So the aging baby boomer population, you know, this isn't a problem. It's a predicament. There are going to be fewer people behind that bulge paying into basically a pyramid scheme, and that's a real predicament. There's just no combination of laws we can pass that's going to change the fact that there are now more retiring people than there are wage earners right behind them. That's just a predicament. And we are surrounded by predicaments right now, including our country peaked in oil production in 1970. We have the best technology in the world. We've got slant bottle brush drilling. We've got all this fracking. We've got incredible technology. And we've never been able to even remotely get close to the old peak of nearly 10 million barrels per day in 1970. Today we're a little over 5.5 million barrels. It's just a predicament. If it was a problem, what we would do is the solution is, well, drill more holes and get more oil out of the ground. That's really not a realistic solution here, because that's not what we're facing. The predicament is we took more than half of all the oil out of the ground, and there just isn't that much down there anymore. It doesn't matter what we do. So right now, I see the DC, the debt debates, they're treating a predicament as if it's a problem. So, what we need is, you mentioned this part, like, well, the consumers aren't borrowing, so that's a problem. So what we'll do is we're going to have the government borrow instead, right? There's a nice problem with a solution. Lack of borrowing, government steps in, does the borrowing. Sounds great. You know, Keynesians love it. Step in. That's how you do it. Well, what if the predicament was that we were actually suffering from too much debt? And the only way to solve that, as such as it is through the outcomes of getting to a lower level of debt, increasing savings, foregoing consumption, and tightening our belts. If we were facing too much debt and we decided to treat that with a solution of applying more debt, you'll find out that in the end, done a couple things. First, you've wasted everybody's time, and time is one of our most valuable assets right now. And the second thing is, often you make what it was you were attempting to fix worse because you're applying a solution to a predicament. And so that's where I really feel very much out of step with the current crop of monetary and fiscal authorities is I keep seeing them diagnose things wrongly. In my estimation, I see them trying to fix things which are inherently unfixable, and they're committing the grievous sins of wasting both time and resources. And so that's the world we're in, and I feel out of step with that. A lot of people feel out of step with that. I think that's where the angst many people feel right now is coming from, is looking at this saying, I see what they're doing, and it just doesn't square up with my reality or what I understand to be reality. What's the problem here? And having this understanding of the difference between a problem and a predicament can be a key to sort of understanding why that disconnect is there and why we feel uncomfortable with what we're seeing.
Well, then if we have predicaments in front of us, what's your suggestion in terms of how to optimize a response?
Well, a predicament really requires an intelligent response. That's what we need to do, is figure out what are the outcomes that are possible here and which ones do we want to navigate towards. So, for instance, you know, if I had a magic wand and was able to run things for a little while, instead of giving $1 trillion to the bankers and letting them, you know, repair their balance sheets, I would have applied that same trillion towards really building up the infrastructure we need to actually make use of our natural gas resources that we have, understanding that the predicament is we're going to have to figure out between here and there, call that 2 decades from now, there is 2 decades away, we have to figure out how to transition from the amount of energy we have to a lower energy lifestyle. Can we do it? No problem. Europe lives on half the energy per capita that the U.S. does, and they live just fine. So I'm sure we can get to a lower energy point. It's going to take a lot of money. It's going to take a lot of investment. But first, we have to understand we're in a predicament, that we cannot rely on the world global energy markets to supply us with ever-increasing amounts of the kind and types and qualities of energy we want forever. We happen to have resources right now. Instead of wasting the time repairing bank balance sheets, what if we built up our own domestic infrastructure, created all of those jobs around that, created all the investment opportunities, and started to learn on our own terms how to live a lower energy lifestyle in ways that we wouldn't even experience as disruptive? Instead, we're going to try and get ourselves back on growth. We're going to pile up the debt even higher. We're going to ignore this looming energy crisis that's just there for anybody who cares to look. We're going to plow into that new reality at fairly high speed at some point in the future. And then we'll have to go into sort of damage, triage, you know, emergency measure kind of stuff, which isn't pretty and never optimal and not quite what anybody would have willingly chosen if they were presented with the options in an appropriate way. But first, we have to get the right narrative. And in this narrative, we don't face an energy problem. We're facing an energy predicament. And we've just got to get that right, or in the future, we're going to get it wrong.
One of the narratives we've experimented here in the last few weeks is treating this as a true turnaround situation. And if you look at a corporate turnaround, time is, as you say, a most valued asset. And you have to identify properly what the issues are. You also have to look at the status quo with a different and fresh set of eyes. Oftentimes in a turnaround situation, much of your upper management is fired because they're a part of the problem. Predicament problem, however you view this, they represent the status quo, and they have lacked for a long time the political will within that organization to change things. We live within a democracy where we're somewhat constrained. No one can step in and fire 535 people. But, you know, what is our, how do we approach the status quo and say, no, you don't understand. We're out of time. Somebody has to make clear-headed decisions here, and it's not going to be on the basis of a groupthink.
I totally agree. Here's one of my biases sneaking out. I don't think that we have time to change things through the normal status quo mechanisms. Right now, if we wanted to, the ideal time to begin navigating this particular energy space would have been probably about 20 years ago. Would have been a great time to look at this. We had all the evidence back then. We chose a different path. We decided to go for this growth model, and so here we are. And so I look at this and I say, look, a normal market-based energy transition takes 40 years on average. We're going to be facing peak oil, I think, in no more than 4 years as an openly discussed international concept. So there just isn't time to wait for market forces to come around. Well, then what's left? Well, then there's some sort of a forcing function, some sort of a crisis mentality that's going to take hold at some point. And in looking at that, you know, all I needed to know about how I want to be when that arrives was given to me by Katrina, right? We had plenty of warning the storm was coming. It came. It destroyed New Orleans, and that place was just an absolute mess of a response for a week or more. And so I look at that, and I say, well, I see this big storm coming. I see relatively low amounts of official awareness around this. And so what's left is for you and I and for corporations that I happen to consult with and other individuals who get it to say, well, given that, you know, it's probably not, we'll hope that the leadership structure gets this in time, but hope alone is a terrible strategy. So what else can we do? And there we want to talk about how we can mitigate these impacts for ourselves with simple, relatively simple things that we can do that make all kinds of sense today. It makes, you know, environmental sense, if you want to look at it that way, economic sense, if you want to look at it that way, lifestyle sense. There's all kinds of ways that we can make perfect sense out of taking mitigating steps today, but they're just a little bit out of the fold. They're just a little bit different than maybe what most other people are doing, and that seems sufficient to block a lot of people from taking those actions. But make no mistake, there's plenty that can be done today. Lots.
And it seems with reference to Katrina, it's a healthy reminder that many of these things are mitigated not at the macro level. There is no sort of great big brother who is there to swoop in and solve the problems. If there's anything that we've learned in the last 3 years, they're very unprepared for the financial storm. And if, in fact, there's an energy storm ahead of us as well, you're right. Lacking political will would be a generous way of describing the opportunities that they've had to make changes along the way and their relative intransigence from the 70s forward. Simplify seems to be a word that would describe, in brief, a micro strategy for families to look at everything that they do and just simplify. The Crash Course is your book, and it's a great read. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I can tell you, because we read so much in the office, there's not much here that I haven't seen before, and you just said it better. You said it in a way that was very approachable. You said it in a way that was from an experienced teacher with the adequate explanations and demonstrations of the fact that you know what you're talking about. So I appreciate you taking the time to explore these things through the years in essay format and now in book format, and I'm sure many of our listeners will join you in reading and processing through in their own families how to apply a simplification at the micro level.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much for the opportunity, and it's been a pleasure.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Dr. Chris Martinson. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.